share,
the market,
the S&P, the ASX
stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that is feeling and sending the love. Tell about that in a second. I'm Scott Phillips. With me, as always, Dr. Anirban Mahati. G'day, Doc. How are you?
Very good, man. How are you?
Happy Valentine's Day, buddy.
Happy Valentine's Day to you, too.
We're feeling the love. We're sending the love. We're all about the love, mate.
We are too much about love.
Too much?
Too much. Well, the only thing is the earnings season might not be giving us love.
Oh, man. Yeah, look, maybe this is the beginning of better times. Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah, maybe the love starts now.
Speaking of starting now, that's a nice segue, buddy. This week, we're going to talk about coronavirus again. Still, we know it's boring. We get it. But it's in the news. It impacts shares and the markets potentially. So we're going to talk on that very, very briefly. And we're going to talk about, as you've already mentioned, mate, earnings season. Some of the big guys were out this week, CBA and Telstra among them. Also, Blackmores. Plus, we've got a couple of little tech companies that you quite like who released earnings this week. And we thought we might talk about, because we figure our listeners want to hear not only about the big guys, but also about some cool little stuff that's going on around the ASX. And not so little anymore, actually, as it turns out, as you reminded me before we recorded. We'll also touch on the TPG Vodafone merger that was off again, is now on again. Maybe. And we will dip, as always, into our favorite, the very, very full, as always, Motley Fool Mailbag. Let's get on with it, mate.
Let's do it.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, mate, let's start with the macro, as we are wont to do here at Motley Fool Money. Coronavirus. Apparently it's got an official name now, I saw during the week, but it's not really catching on with anybody, so we're also calling it coronavirus, and I think we'll probably do that. We're not...
Isn't it just called novel coronavirus?
Oh, it's NC19 or something.
NCOV19?
That's the one. There you go. So you've been paying attention.
Well, I just made it up.
Everyone's going to call it coronavirus.
It's just coronavirus.
So, mate, look, I guess, you know, look, it's still in the news. There was numbers out, I want to say it was Wednesday night, I think, that another 242 deaths had been recorded in China. Mate, huge health issue. And as we say every time, not to give it lip service, but to be genuine, you know, this is a real health issue with real consequences for people, people dying, families grieving, lots going on there. So we don't want to make light on it at all. And we don't. We are, though, an investing podcast. So the question turns to where to from here, or more importantly, what's going on. I got to say right now, I've been vocal in the past by saying the market overreacted early on. Maybe, just maybe, the market's learned something. Maybe they're listening to me. Is that possible?
Okay, so I'll take the other side on that. I think just because it's fun to take the other side.
First things first, before you do, the what I was going to say at least is the market doesn't seem worried about coronavirus at the moment. There don't seem to be a lot of market moves on the back of new news out of China, despite things like the extra 242 deaths the other day.
Yeah, so here's the thing. I think the market, I'll take the other side of it. I think the market is, to some extent, underpricing what's going on, largely because, right. I mean, in one day... I think it was on Wednesday night or Tuesday night,
one of those days.
The number of infections increased by 15,000 in one single day.
Right.
And that's because they've gone, I think, door to door and basically done screening and they've found 15,000 new cases.
Right, okay.
That tells me a couple of different things. I think either market is under and you know, anticipating what's going to happen because previously the claim was that this thing is going to be over by March end or something like that. And usually, you know, like basically coronavirus is, you know, at a very high level, another type of flu, right? And the flu typically, you know, we're in Australia, so we're in the Southern Hemisphere. We forget that the Northern Hemisphere is actually in winter.
Yeah, right.
And as winter sort of subsides, flu basically is done. Right?
Okay, that's right.
So the theory there is that, you know, as temperatures increase around April or so, things should get back to normal.
Okay.
However, if the rate of cases are underreported, then we don't know, A, how much more has it spread in China.
Right.
China is a manufacturing hub of the world. China is also an important trading partner for several nations, including Australia. And two, the flow-on effects of that is, A, you know, so there's consumption of goods that is affected. There's also production of goods that is affected. There's also other things that are affected, such as, you know, consumption of resources, you know, tourism and so on for countries.
Factories are closed down for a while.
Yeah.
So fewer Chinese people
if
traveling.
If I was to take a bet, I would say that actually this thing is going to drag on for much longer than I think people are anticipating. And the markets are, to some extent... not really accounted for that. Now, I think there's a dichotomy here. What I've noticed is some tech companies are actually doing really well.
Okay.
consumer discretionary companies are kind of jumping around.
Yep.
And that sort of makes sense
yeah,
at a very high level, largely because, and I'm making this distinction because a lot of tech companies, if you think about software companies, they have zero business in China.
Right.
Now, there are flow-on effects, but if it stays contained to China, those businesses are actually not affected because they neither produce anything there, neither consume anything there. So it's okay.
Right. The worst version of the future for them is that just economic growth broadly slows and they're hit with some sort of confidence issue, right? Where people just say, well, let's not go and do that new thing because maybe the economy is going for a rough patch.
Exactly. But if you're, you know, if you have a sticky software, you're likely to use it. If in fact, if you're looking to cut costs, there's a converse theory here. If you're looking to cut costs, probably you actually want to automate more things, right? So I think those businesses have become the go-to defense stock in that sense. Whereas I think consumer discretionary stocks, I mean, they're guaranteed to be hit.
Yep.
Like, I mean, whether or not we agree, but they're guaranteed to be hit now in the short term, right? And the question then in my mind is, when something gets hit in the short term, how much is the correction?
Right.
Now, I'm not saying anything about the long term, but the market, we know, loves the short term and makes short term corrections. So what I am saying right now is the market is actually not corrected enough for the short term. That's my thesis.
I actually think you're kind of right, but I guess my broader point is that if the market was rational, as opposed to where so you're right, that generally what happens with these sorts of unexpected shocks is the market does react meaningfully on the downside because it just freaks out, right, about the news. I would argue that that is wrong in the first place because the long-term earnings power of those businesses hasn't necessarily changed, right? Unless you're going to go broke in the meantime, if you look out to 2023, just to pick a year, this is all blown over. And unless your business is structurally damaged permanently by the coronavirus outbreak, we get back to normal. And if we're long-term investors looking forward, we're buying future earnings. So I personally would be saying, I really don't actually care what happens to earnings in this half. What I care about for company X, and doesn't really matter which one it is that in 2023, if it's back earning the same level of profit, then I should be paying a multiple of that future profit, not worrying about the short term. In other words, any short-term passing issues should be ones the market should look through anyway, because it just doesn't matter for the overall earnings power of these businesses. I think that's what I'd say. There shouldn't be a big drop exactly for that reason, not because the short term won't be problematic earnings-wise, just because it shouldn't matter to most investors most of the time, because the long-term earnings power is what we should be focused on.
That's all true, except that the market is not rational.
Right, but that's what we're arguing about, right? Is to some degree, you're saying, well, the market hasn't done what the market normally does.
Yep.
I guess I'm saying that's a good thing in that case, because at least maybe the market's finally seeing some sense.
That's not a good thing at all, in my opinion. Because if the market is becoming irrational, it just makes my job as an investor really hard. I like the market being irrational.
So you want the market to fall so you can buy some stuff cheap, is that what you're telling me?
Well, that's exactly what I like. I mean, here's the thing, right? If stuff falls, then stuff becomes cheaper. If you're a net buyer of stocks, then that's awesome. I know this kind of sounds very counterintuitive, but I mean, if stuff falls because it falls irrationally, then, you know, well, that's great. The other thing I'll say, though, is like if you think about companies and you think about their earnings and you think about them being discounted cash flows into the future, well, it does matter how much the earnings of the year one actually is, right?
Sure.
Because, I mean, that has a higher weight than anything else in the future, right?
Sure,
so, of course, in 2023, 2025, the earnings might be great. That has a much lower weight depending upon what discount rates. I mean, the other fact could be the market is just assigning permanently a very low discount rate. So, therefore, it doesn't really matter whether the earnings are in the future or in the present.
Right.
You know, it's all kind of like, you know, heebie-jeebie in that sense, right? But if that's the case, you know, it's still, I think some businesses are going to have pain. You know, travel, consumer discretionary businesses, I think are likely to see pain. And I think the market is probably not realizing is there's current pain, and then there's some flow on pain. So this is like not really a short term thing. If this thing doesn't finish until like April, May, you know, we've got half a year of pain.
Yeah.
And then maybe another half a year of sort of recovery pain before things get to normal. I'd expect some discount for that. Like, I mean, as an investor, I'd like to get some discount for that. But if I don't get it, I'll just stay away from that stock.
But you're also going to buy the discount because you know the price is going to go back to some more reasonable level, right? So at some level, you're saying, I think the stock is being priced less than what it's actually worth. That's why I'm going to go shopping because I'm getting the discount.
Yeah, like I would like to get the discount. I just don't think that some of them are discounted appropriately at this moment. That's just my theory.
Let's tangent from that nicely because you mentioned being a net buyer and I love the fact, mate, I'm always happy when you quote Warren Buffett is basically what I'm saying. Because to your point, your exact point, Buffett has said many, many times that long-term investors, and look, for most listeners here, most listeners are probably already investing, probably already know this. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. Maybe they've forgotten it. Maybe some are, frankly, new to investing. So what I wanted to just very quickly just hone in on is that idea of being a net buyer, right? The market, the news media, frankly, a lot of the financial media will say the market's down, that's terrible. Now, if you're a retiree, if you're going to retire tomorrow, sell everything and buy a boat, then shares dropping today is a really, really crappy thing, right? Because you can buy less boat with your dollars. For everybody else, either, if you are, by the way, including retirees who are simply going to allow their portfolios to compound over time and reinvest some of those dividends, if you're a net buyer, in other words, if you're planning to buy more than you're going to sell over any extended period of time, you actually should like the fact that share prices fall. Even though it's painful for our current portfolio, so you and I, if the market drops 10%, we're worth 10% less, and that's kind of painful. But it gives us the opportunity to buy shares that we're going to hold, hopefully, for 10, 20, 30 years, or at least capital we're going to compound in the same or different shares for that period of time, to actually get shares cheaper, right? And so that idea of being a net buyer and then wanting stocks to be lower as a result, that's kind of really, really important.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, on the other hand, I'll just caveat by saying, like, you know, somebody wants to be buying boat or is retired. I mean, they should really, in theory, have some amount of money available in cash or cash-like asset that is de-risked from sort of the market volatility, right?
Correct, correct.
And if that happens, then actually, you know, if you have cash to buy stuff, maybe you can actually buy things instead of being worried about, you know, that your wealth has become less. I mean, the wealth effect is real. I hate it when my account looks down. You feel a little silent joy for the paper gains, right? I mean, those things are very real, but you kind of got to work that out. Mm. So, I mean, you quoted Buffett. I mean, you know, Buffett has good quotes. I just think Buffett investing is dead, but that's a different conversation altogether.
Yeah, no, that's very different. We'll have that another time.
But, you know, maybe that's for another day.
Probably another day.
Yeah, but you know that. So I think that quote is correct. You know, on long term buyer, you want to buy things when you can.
Yeah.
At a discount.
Yeah, exactly. We should want to have cheaper assets to buy, particularly if they're a short term discount. We should actually love that. Like, if you know something's worth $100 and you get an opportunity every few years to buy it for 70, then you should want it. You should want that discount. Even though the stuff you've got in the back shed is now worth less in theory compared to the current market price, if you can go and buy some more of whatever it is, Buffett's talked about hamburgers in the past, petrol in the past, you actually want the price to be lower. I think there's a quote something like, you know, being unhappy about share prices falling is like being unhappy about petrol prices falling because you've already got a tank of gas. What's that effect, right? We call it petrol, of course. But that idea of, you know, if you said, wow, petrol's gone down, that's terrible. I've already bought a tank, got a full tank of petrol. Terrible, the price has gone down. You kind of go, yeah, okay, but you're going to fill up that tank a couple of, you know, maybe once a week, once a fortnight for the rest of your life. Mm. The fact that your current petrol, you know, you paid a little bit too much for it, or maybe just simply it's worth less now, should be much, much less relevant. The fact you're going to buy a whole lot more for a whole lot cheaper in future.
People are not going to be filling their tanks in the next 30 years. So that problem, I think, I've solved for Buffett.
I can't believe I went there.
And about burgers, I don't know. Maybe there'll be like fake burgers everywhere. So I think Buffett is in trouble. Real trouble.
How did I manage to get me into that one?
Well, you just pulled it yourself. I didn't do anything.
Can we move on?
Yeah, sure.
Please, thank you. All right.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, mate. From Buffett and electric/petrol cars to earnings season. There's no easy segue for that, so I'm just going to go with that. Mate, talk to me about some of what's happened this week. So let's go through the big names first. I imagine you might have a view on this. I'm speculating. You might possibly have a view.
I have a view on everything.
So Commonwealth Bank. Now, so there's two things I want to contrast here. The headline on Nine News this week was Commonwealth Bank smashes expectations with a $4.48 billion 6-month profit. Now, two things there. The first is smashes expectations, good thing. Mm-hmm. Second, $4.48 billion 6-month profit, also a good thing. You read down the second paragraph, it says, but a flat net operating income result, as well as higher expenses and a 12.5% increase in loan impairments, meant the figure for the 6 months to December was 4.3% down on last year's $4.7 billion. Now, what isn't said there, because this was put out before the market opened, is shares then went up on the news. Now, that's not unusual. We've said before, and we'll say probably every earnings season forever, at least until they kick us off this podcast, that earnings season really should be renamed expectation season, because it really is about not how much did the company grow by, but what was the market expecting. And in this case, the market was expecting a worse result. And so if you've already priced that in, if the market is forward-looking and saying, well, okay, look, we'll pay a little bit less for the shares because we think it's going to be a terrible result, the good result being a good one, at least relative to those expectations, should see the share price rise, which all makes sense. But are they really going to pay 18 times earnings for a bank that's having 5% lower profits?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have a lot of things to say. I think CBA as an investment, in my mind, is problematic for many, many reasons, right? I mean, mm-hmm. first of all, I think you've got to remember that the market that it operates in, right, is a very competitive market. It's a small market. Mm-hmm. It's a heavily debt-loaded up the wazoo market. it's like it's everything that you don't actually want. It's not. It's at the tail end of potential loan growth market, mm-hmm. right? It's everything that you don't want. It's this concoction where if something goes wrong, a lot of bad things can happen. At that point, I don't want to be owning CBA shares. That's number one. Okay. I think about CBA
at any price or at the current price.
Well, at any price, right? Okay. Because the reason at any price is there are so many equities to own, right? Why would I own an equity that is so tied to so many risk factors? It just doesn't make sense. Even if I want the, if I want the yield, I buy something else. But in my mind, when people are so debt loaded, disposable income to net debt is so high. Mm. I mean, there's only... either there is like a drop, substantive drop, or a flat outcome for several years, right?
Right.
And in neither of those things look good. I mean, if it's a flat outcome, then 18 times earnings looks silly.
Doesn't it?
And if it is a drop, 18 times earnings looks downright silly. The cash profits were down, what, 4% or something. Mm. Operating income was sequentially down or up, I think a little bit up. Expenses were up. Loan impairments were, I think, up.
Up 12.5%, yes.
What? I mean, those numbers are like, they're scary if you think about the way banks operate, right? Banks operate with so much leverage. I just can't justify buying... I'd buy CBA at like 12 times, 10 times to 12 times earnings. That, in my mind, is an appropriate multiple for a bank like CBA. For the growth it has, irrespective of the quality and the fact that people think it's going to be bailed out if there is trouble, right? And it probably will be bailed out if there is trouble. But
it's worth saying, by the way, being bailed out doesn't mean what most people think it means.
Yeah,
being bailed out keeps the bank in business and looks after depositors. But like some of the UK banks, Lloyds, Northern Rock, a couple of others, shareholders were effectively wiped out. The bank was bailed out, yes. But if you're an investor and you think that means you're going to be saved, you're going to have another quick look.
Yeah, they definitely. I agree with that. I was going to say that. Being bailed out does not mean shareholders are going to be fine. Being bailed out basically means depositors are going to be fine and yes, there'll be a banking operation, right? So I'm not ever speculating that, I don't think any of our big banks are going to disappear. Yep. That doesn't mean that shareholders' wealth can be, as in the line of credit, you're way down below.
Oh, mate, absolutely.
Everyone, right?
Yep.
So the
very,
banks
very
are
last
exist.
In line.
Yeah, you're last in line. The banks are going to exist. Yeah. So, I would, at this price, CBA is a sell for me. Mm. I'd run up the hill as far as I can, as fast as I can, away from CBA, as fast as I can.
I'm not as negative about it as you are, mate, but I'm not positive at all. I have to say, I think one of the things we need to, as investors, try and work out, and we don't know the answer to this yet. We might have different views or maybe even the same view on it, but low interest rates for a long period of time does mean that PEs should be higher than they have been in the past. So banks have traded traditionally between 11 and 14 times earnings, generally speaking. There's always exceptions at different ends. But that was when interest rates were, 5, 6%. I'm talking about the rates that we're paying, not necessarily just the RBA's charging. At a much lower interest rate environment where the rate's probably like half of what it used to be, there is a case, I think, across the board for all companies to pay a little bit more just on the basis of the math that goes behind that. We won't get into the weeds here because maths on radio is a terrible, terrible thing. So there's a basis for paying more than we have in the past for every business, including the banks, just on a in this case, a rising tide lifts all boats kind of basis. I do agree with you, though, in terms of the sheer paying 18 times earnings for business that has A, declining profits, and B, there was a tweet from Elise Morgan who hosts the ABC's The Business Program, and the tweet just says, in her words, "How does CEO Matt Comyn get Commonwealth Bank's profits growing again?" And then she quotes him saying, "It's going to be difficult." And then she says, "And after a big bounce in borrowing, where's the limit?" That's basically what you just said, mate. But even when Matt Comyn, the CEO, is saying, "Look, I don't know where profit growth comes from," there's some basis for paying a higher multiple of earnings in a low rate environment, but there's almost no basis for paying 18 times earnings for a flat to declining profit business. It's hard to pay a low enough price, because if you're paying 18 times earnings this year and profits fall by 5%, well, guess what? That's effectively 19 times next year. So you actually be paying less next year than you're paying this year, even if the multiple is justified, which I don't think it is. But as you say, you know, that's the risk. I don't really know, other than someone sitting on massive capital gains who simply doesn't feel like they can reinvest the cash at a high enough rate, and even then they probably should do it anyway. But I kind of understand that thinking. I really, really don't understand why you'd be significantly exposed to the banks, in particular Commonwealth, at these kind of prices.
Yeah, I'm 99% agree with you. I'd still not give it a higher. You know, the problem with giving it a higher multiple is, I think we have to make the assumption that the rates are going to be fundamentally low for a very long time, right? In that case, you know, like, I mean, a bank like this probably trades in various other markets at around 12 times PE. Mm-hmm. Now, comparative is dangerous or difficult because, you know, are we making the assumption that they are fair? But, you know, the best way to think about these things is in book value terms, really not in earnings terms. It's best to think about them in book value terms. And I think a bank should, you know, 1.2 times, 1.3, 4 times maybe book value is probably appropriate. I mean, at 1.4, I think it's more than appropriate for a bank like that. I don't know what it is, but last one I had checked was pretty high. Let me have a look just to make sure that maybe let me see what ComSec says about price to book value here.
While you're doing that, I will only for the sake of balance, again, we don't strongly disagree, but I want to present something as a devil's advocate view. The thing I would say about our banks versus the other banks is that, frankly, any consumer knows our banks are obscenely profitable and obscenely dominant in their market. And I think this last time I checked, mate, there was like 2,000 US banks, something ridiculous like that. That's great for competition for Americans, and it's great for it's great for keeping prices down. I will say to some degree that the old four pillars policy that's been government policy for, man, I want to say 25 plus years now. I think it might have been Keating as treasurer who kind of put the gave it that phrase, or at least was in charge when that phrase was given to the banks. To some degree, being protected from competition and being able to run as a relatively cozy oligopoly. There's an argument, I think, in any other industry. Again, if we put banks aside now and our views on banks generally. If you had four reasonably cozy, a bit like the airlines in the US, right? At some point when there's few enough of them, funnily enough, margins start to go up. And that is worth something more than in a truly competitive marketplace.
I'll just say price to tangible book value is 2.5x. Ouch.
That's a lot. Let's move on.
I'll just sell it.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Speaking of stocks you love, should we move to Telstra?
Oh, I love that. Let's do that.
Now, let's do what... unfortunately, it wasn't such a great headline this time for Telstra. The headline was pretty straightforward. Telstra first half profit dropped 7.6% as NBN headwinds take a $360 million toll. Now, in this case, a little bit like Commonwealth Bank, that drop was big, but it was also in line with guidance and expectations, as the New Daily says, with the cost of the NBN rollout again weighing significantly on the telco's balance sheet, as they say. So, mate, revenue down 3-ish% from memory. The dividends being maintained. The shares were, I'm pretty sure, up when this was announced. Was it yesterday? So the market kind of was happy enough that Telstra was doing what it said it was going to do. It's again based on expectations. It delivered on what it said. The future looks about as what, you know, the way people expected it. It's a pretty pedestrian-ish result, at least relative to expectations, but not a great result in absolute terms.
Yeah. So as I said on our online discussions yesterday, I looked at the earnings release to the market that they put out, or the commentary that they put out, the 5-pager or 7-pager, and in the first 5 lines, there were 3 decreases or decrease that I could spot. That is usually a bad sign in my view. Now, I will say one thing. Telstra, though, like on an earnings basis, and I guess there's some question marks, I think, about on the business right now, which actually, ironically, might actually work out in their favor. But it actually looks decently priced, right? You're paying about 12 times something, 12 times earnings or 13 times earnings for this business. You know, it's probably close to what I would say is fair value for this business. So, I mean, I'm not as anti-owning Telstra at this price.
What?
Aren't you surprised?
I'm very surprised. I've fallen off my virtual chair here, mate.
Should I own CB8 18 or 19 or whatever ridiculous price to earnings it is on versus Telstra? I'll add one more thing to Telstra. I think Telstra has been suffering from the NBN pain like any other many of our telcos have been. The hope here might be that as 5G starts rolling out. Mm. Maybe they will actually be able to ease off the NBN pain by offering 5G for broadband, right? And if that happens, maybe their margins actually can go up.
That's the thing that really gets me. Look, so I'm a Telstra shareholder. It's a recommendation of ours. So I put both those on the table very early. It's an old recommendation. I think it's a hold for us at ShareAdvisor, if I remember rightly. It's underwhelmed, right? And that's very clear. I had expected, I think I've done this mea culpa before, I had expected the mobile margins to grow more quickly and overwhelm the declining fixed line margins more quickly than they did. The numbers were very clear. The numbers have kind of rolled out exactly as you'd expect, except in terms of the mix between fixed and mobile and the different margins there. We knew that the mobile margin is about half of the fixed line margins, and that's always going to hurt, right? When you take a dollar of fixed line away and you put in a dollar of mobile, your margins still fall by half, and that's been their biggest issue. I'm no tech guru, as our listeners well and truly know, mate, but I've got to figure, as you kind of point out, The real jewel in the crown here is its 5G network, the breadth, the size, the coverage area, the speed. I mean, I don't think anyone, and maybe it's not even true, but I think everyone would agree, maybe with tiny exceptions, Telstra has the best mobile network out there, or is at least perceived to have the best mobile network, and that is marketing gold for the company. In an NBN world, once 5G is kind of up and running, these 5G kind of Wi-Fi hotspot things that people are going to potentially have in their homes rather than the NBN, this might be one of those kind of, temporary slowdowns for Telstra that takes off again if and when 5G can be used at large scale and at large speed.
Yeah, so I mean, the 5G is going to be a small cell network, right? So I mean, they're going to have many, many small cells, and theoretically, you can get very high download and upload speeds with it, right?
Right, right.
Now, if you can get somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 megabits per second, like I have got NBN. And basically, I had to downgrade to tier two because I can't get tier one because the last mile is ridiculously slow.
And 5G beats copper, generally speaking, right?
5G is totally going to beat that because I can get like 40 megabits per second max,
right,
in the shared network. And I potentially could get 150 plus megabits per second on a 5G. Actually, theoretically, you can get much higher.
Right.
So, I'm sure that given in this age where we have, multiple, devices streaming videos at the same time and you want to watch 4K and, high def and whatnot, and you want to play these multiplayer games, download and upload bandwidth matter right now. I think in many pockets, NBN services don't, deliver that.
Yeah.
And if they don't deliver that, I think there's an opportunity, in a market opportunity for companies that deliver. And the other interesting thing is that, TPG, for example, does not have 5G plans yet, or the combination maybe has 5G plans. Yep. But I mean, Telstra has a advantageous position here to be the first one to roll out a big nationwide. And then they could actually use that as a bundling strategy, offer the 5G network at home and 5G mobile.
Right.
And that could be a winning strategy. So I'm actually not, at this price, I'm actually quite okay with Telstra.
I'm unbelievable.
You did not know that, did you?
I'm speechless, right? And for a podcast, that's not a good thing. Maybe we should just move on.
Let's move on.
Value stocks.
Market. Stock market.
Index. Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, I reckon this week is just my week to look like a deal, frankly, and feel pretty stupid because not only do I own Telstra, although that hasn't done badly this week, but I also happen to own Blackmore's shares. And let's just say it wasn't a pretty set of results. The company was characteristically and frankly pleasingly, but also disappointingly in the case of the data itself, came in and said, look, this is unacceptable. We know it's unacceptable. It's a terrible result. We know we're sorry. And I'll give them some marks for at least doing that. And to some degree, there's a new management team in place. But literally saying, look, we screwed up. We got it wrong. We made a mistake. We're sorry. We're fixing it. It's the least you can expect, except that in a lot of companies, they would try to obfuscate and hide and dissemble and try and, point to everything else except for what's going on. Maybe, though, to be fair, or unfair, in Blackmore's case, there wasn't much else to point to. They blamed production issues. They blamed coronavirus. They blamed their product mix. They blamed their pricing. And they blamed their promotions. Now, I'm not sure what else is left. As a shareholder, I love the brand. I used to work there many years ago, for the record and full disclosure. But it's a slightly bizarre, phenomenal in a terrible way, set of results where they actually may make a loss in the second half. How so bad have things become?
Oh, you want me to comment on that?
I figure I should at least let you have the opportunity to.
Well, you know, I have multiple thoughts on this. So, I mean, I don't mind Blackmore as a company, but I think there are a couple of things going on here. One is, I think the market was now, with the full benefit of hindsight, I guess, which I'm going to upfront own. I think the issue with Blackmore's is the question: how much of a brand premium should we be paying for something like Blackmore's? I think that's, in my mind, that's number one question. Mm. It is a brand. Like, it's like basically saying Ford has a brand, mm-hmm. but is it a brand worth a premium? I think that's number one question in my mind. So I absolutely get it that there's a lot of opportunity in the Asian continent for a company like Blackmore's.
Yep.
A large population, we are nearby, there's demand. But I mean, it's in some sense, vitamins are a commodity, right? Anybody can produce a vitamin, anybody mm-hmm. can put a sticker on it and sell it. It's very hard, in my view, to create substantive brand premium for that. That's at least what I'm thinking. So I think there's two aspects here. One is that, you know, the market was treating, for the lack of a better comparison, maybe was treating Blackmore's like Louis Vuitton. Like, you know, it's, I would not treat, I mean, you know, Louis Vuitton basically sells the same, you know, well, I'm sure, again, this Louis Vuitton might come after me, so I'll caveat that. but you know, so it's basically, you know, you can buy this leather bag from someone that looks kind of like Louis Vuitton, but it's not as polished as Louis Vuitton, and you can buy the Louis Vuitton thing for $2,000. I mean, that is, I think, brand premium,
right?
I don't think you can have brand premium like of that scale or magnitude mm-hmm. with vitamins. Mm-hmm. So I think the market still, in my view, has not probably adjusted for that. There's too much of a brand premium for stuff that's not really at a brand premium. Mm. Number two, I think this is fascinating in my view. If a company comes out and predicts that next half, I'm going to actually make no money. Mm. I'm probably going to dip into loss. Actually, the shares did not fall, which in my mind, basically the market is saying you have a brand premium to some extent and that your earnings are going to recover. So,
well, shares did fall 13%, but as you say, on the back of a profit fall of 48%, that was a pretty generous fall. You could also argue, unfortunately for me who own shares at a higher price, to some degree the market already factored in some disappointing news as well.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the market has bummed down the shares for a while. But yep. I mean, again, I'll go back to, like, I mean, you know, this thing is selling on a price to earnings ratio of what, 25 trailing? Or 30 trailing, something like 25 trailing, right? Mm. I mean, is it really worth 25 trailing? I mean, maybe in a low PE, low interest rate world. I mean, those are the questions in my mind. And I think, again, there's some questionable decisions about, you know, the manufacturing stuff that they're doing. I mean, you know, why do you really need to own if you're doing vitamin manufacturing, why do you really need to own the supply chain?
I've said before in many different, like I say, that there's one of the worst decisions they've made as a business.
Yeah.
They don't need to own the supply chain. You're taking a whole lot of capital costs, a capital heavy business. They used to buy someone else's product, bottle it and send it out again. Super capital light, lots of great cash flow. I get supply chain control, I get production control. You want to make sure you can supply. I kind of get all that stuff. I got to say, it just strikes me as the most bizarre thing.
It's vitamins. I mean, how hard is it to acquire supply, right? I mean, so some of those decisions.
To be fair, there have been in the past raw ingredient shortages that Blackmore's have struggled with back as long as when I was back there a decade or so ago. So it does happen from time to time because the global demand does outstrip global supply sometimes. So I understand the rationale. I understand the thinking behind why you would look at it. I just can't see how that is better than not owning it and, frankly, dealing with the supply issues.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's there's some questionable decisions there. And you know, this was made, again, it's easy to say those decisions are questionable because they're now, you know, the contributing reasons for a loss.
Oh,
right?
No, I'm pretty sure I'm on record of saying it was a terrible thing at the time.
I'm just caveating that by saying that, it's nice for me to say, well, you know, did that, right?
We mightn't have mentioned it if they'd done well with it, right?
Exactly, right? You did not have talked about it. So I'm just being very clear about that. But I'm just saying, I think that, you know, I actually, this was the most surprising reaction, I thought, this earnings season. was there was a lot of bad news. Mm. And it was like, you know, throwing the entire kitchen sink at, like, you know, okay, all the bad news are going to get out at one go.
Yeah.
And the shares didn't respond. So, I mean, you know, I'm just taking the other side. I'm saying that there's a fair bit of premium baked into it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not personally sure whether that premium is worthwhile. I mean, you know, is there growth to justify the premium? I would not pay a brand premium for it. I would pay a growth premium for it. So if they deliver me growth, I would pay the premium. But if they don't pay me the growth, I would question the premium.
Yeah. For what it's worth, and as a holder, and just I argue my own wallet here, but also to be devil's advocate a little bit, I think it's reasonable to say that Blackmores over a very long period of time has demonstrated it does have a brand premium. Now, how big that is and what it's worth is an open question. They've been able to sell higher priced vitamins for, well, I mean, the company's been around for 80 years, but particularly in the last, say, 20 or 30 years, they've been the number one vitamin brand in Australia for most of that time, certainly recently. So there is some, you know, consumers are prepared to pay more for Blackmores. That's absolutely happening and remains the case. So there is some brand benefit, brand value there. Is it worth some of the price you're talking about? I guess that's the open question, right? But I think the marketplace experience would say that people are prepared to pay more for Blackmores vitamins because they have whatever we want to call brand, whether that's trust, whether that's recognition, whether that's scale, whether that's promotional activity, whatever those things are, there has been for a couple of decades at least, you know, Blackmores has been able to command a price premium.
Yeah, no, I disagree with that. The point I was trying to make basically is that, okay, I'll take Louis Vuitton, stock at at one end, right?
Course,
and I'll pay a brand premium. I mean, I get the Louis Vuitton brand premium, why people are paying for it, yep. Right? People line up for buying those bags, right? And maybe you could make the argument that, you know, the stuff disappears from the shelves for Blackmores as well, and maybe that's worth the brand premium. But, you know, in my mind, if I draw the parallel, I think it's worth, everything is a brand. Even Ford is a brand.
Sure.
You know, Louis Vuitton is a brand. But I'm just thinking of the brand premium, the level to which people are paying for the brand premium.
Right.
Maybe it's not appropriate. The other thing, you know, which is, I think we tend to pay a brand premium ahead of time. It's all easy to say in hindsight again. I love stuff in hindsight.
so much easier to be right, isn't it?
It's just, you know, it's easy to theorize in hindsight. Again, I'm just making that very clear for listeners because, you know, it's easy to say yeah. things in retrospect yeah. of a result. Yeah. But the other thing I was thinking is, it is still an open question in my mind whether or not the brand premium that is, say, in Australia, does it actually translate to Asia, right? And if it does translate to Asia, then absolutely, because what happened, actually, then you should be paying a lot more for that brand premium because that market is substantially bigger.
Right.
I think it has yet to prove maybe whether that is true. Mm-hmm. But if it proves that, I think then the brand premium becomes higher because you're just going to a larger growth market, you know, a growing market and things like that. So, I mean, you know, there's some interesting questions there.
Yeah.
Investing is hard. is all I can say.
I think it's a very, very good summary. Should we go to some of the small stuff you like?
Yeah, we could go. My smaller stuff has no brand.
Here we go.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, so we've done a little bit of the big end of town. We've done a bit of the macro. Let's get, I was going to say micro, but mate, some of these companies are doing fantastically well. We haven't got all that much time, but let's spend a little bit of time on Elmo and Megaport. Now, Elmo is not the Sesame Street monster, cute and furry though he is. Elmo in this case, do you know why they call it Elmo? Does it stand for something? Or is it someone's surname?
You know, it's basically enhanced learning and something.
There's a
reason why it's actually called Elmo. I actually keep forgetting it.
Was it named before the Sesame Street character or after? Because I've got to say,
I just remember that.
It doesn't help me. All right, so Elmo, it's an HR software company.
Yeah.
Little Australian mob. Doing really, really well. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so just to quickly say what they do. So they basically provide HR software for basically doing, you know, leaves, recruitment, you know, basically all the usual HR stuff plus payroll. So it's basically a comprehensive suite of solutions that is small, what they call the small, you know, the mid-market.
Right.
And the small market. So basically SMB style market enterprises are the ones which they are targeting, right? And they provide the solution, a cloud-based solution entirely. So they're doing really well. You know, their revenue was up some 41% over the half. It's an acquisitive company, but organic growth was about 32%. I think that the thing, though, that's interesting is that, you know, what I like to see is this is a sticky software business. So basically you sign up for, say, a three-year term. You pay maybe quarterly or yearly or half-yearly in advance. So you know actually what your cash flow is going to be. And, you know, so that's the recurring revenue, or the, how much of the revenue you think is going to recur. And that recurring revenue is growing at a decent clip of about 40%, 43%, 44%, wow, okay. right? So half year, you know, the recurring revenue stood at $52 million. If you just annualize that, this is an $100 million recurring revenue run rate. Actually, I should not annualize that because, let me take that. If it's $52 million annual recurring revenue, then it's $52 million and then growing at some because it's an annual rate. Right?
Okay, so makes sense. Yeah.
I'll take that back.
Don't double it too quickly.
Yeah.
So this is important. So annual run rate's important, right? Because what it's basically saying is we have – so rather – they're kind of bringing forward some of the, not bringing forward in an accounting sense, but they're trying to let the market know what to expect moving forward. What they're saying is we've signed up customers who have agreed to pay us in total $52 million a year, even though we haven't got all that money just yet because we signed up someone yesterday, they've signed up for a year, and so on a yearly basis, this is how much this customer's worth. They're trying to give us a sense of what the kind of business as usual is for these new customers.
Yeah, and there are a couple of things that I really like about this style of business, right? One is the sort of the guarantee to some extent, no revenue is guaranteed, and you could say that, you know, Woolies is also recurring because everybody's got to go to groceries, right? But
Right. Well, I think that's a reasonable question, but not what you're trying to say.
Yeah, but I mean, so you know, the way this company works is they've got a bunch of modules. So modules are things like I've got a hiring module, I've got a payroll module, I've got a retention module, I've got some learning modules, right? They've got 13 modules. And typically, people maybe have two or three or four, and the average is like 2 point something right now. New people are signing up with a much higher number of modules. They're signing up with 3+ modules on average, right? So that's pretty interesting.
That is.
But what is interesting is that over time, you have the potential to upsell to the same mob, that your same mob being the clients or customers, additional modules.
So is it, this is what I find this interesting in the sense that we've got to be a little bit careful with growth rates, right? Like if Elmo was to sign up one module now, one module next year, one module the year after, we think great growth company. If they sign three modules now, we say, oh, there's less growth because there's still three modules next year. How do you think about that in terms of, you know, the more they sign up now, the less growth they've got kind of by definition, but the more cash they get today?
Yeah.
Well, how do you kind of square that circle?
Well, so, I mean, the way I look at it is that they've got three modules right now. Let's say on average, let's say new people are coming in and signing three, but there's 13. So there's a lot of upside still there. Right, you can double, you can quadruple actually.
Okay.
Total number of modules theoretically can go to 12, 13, right?
Okay. So there's still plenty of growth left.
And then in terms of the total market opportunity, like, I mean, the company says it's like something like $2 billion annual plus, right? They made a small acquisition recently that expands their opportunity into UK. Now the company was very, very cautious in the comments they made in the conference call in terms of saying, oh, you know, okay, we don't know, we just did this and it's, you know, it's time. But that... it's a small acquisition that is a small step into UK. UK market is 3 times the size of our market, right?
Yeah.
So I'll watch that. And I like the way they're going about it. It's going about small. So, yeah, I think those things are interesting. The customers paying up more next year than this year, that's interesting because they're signing up more modules. So, yeah, I think...
it's kind of built in revenue growth, right? Which is kind of nice.
Built-in revenue growth.
No nice guarantees, but a reasonably high likelihood.
Yeah, nice growth, small little growth company. So
I'm going to assume it's a buy for you.
Yeah, we love it. It's a buy.
Very good. Mate, this is one of the companies I don't claim, as our listeners very well know, to be a tech expert. That's why you're here, because... I make you look good.
Thank you.
Well, it's not hard, mate, compared to me, but you are generally a smart bloke and a computer science PhD, no less. So you don't need me to demonstrate your smartness. Mate, Megaport. So I love this idea. It's kind of fractionalizing data access in a way that, well, this is how I think about it. You'll describe it properly in a minute. But what I love about it is it's kind of Uberizing to some degree data transmission, the pipes that we send our data along, the ability to kind of have data. I mean, think about AWS again in a different way, Amazon Web Services, the ability to use cloud computing. This is kind of like cloud, cloud in some ways, right? It's cloud data flow, data access. And I just love that someone's come along and basically said, hey, we got this pipe and the whole pipe costs $100. You either got to pay the pipe or you don't. And that was kind of the old days. And only a few companies really needed the whole pipe at any one point in time. These days, they can say to a dozen companies, hey, pay us all $10, $20 each to get access when you need it. knowing full well, by the way, if you multiply 12 customers by 20, you get $240. You can effectively resell that same, not the same access, but the same type of access, the same way Amazon Web Services does, for a much, much higher price. I'm really, really impressed by the smarts behind it, by the fact it's possible and the fact someone's doing it. So that being said, I don't understand the company well enough to know what the long term looks like, although I do know you like it. So tell our listeners firstly where I'm wrong about the description and what I explained badly, and then kind of give us a sense of what you liked about the most recent result.
Yeah, I think you actually did a fantastic description of the company. Like, I mean, if you think about, say, like an airport, like say think about the Gold Coast Airport, right? It has a certain amount of bandwidth demand because people are sitting there, and at certain points in time, there's more traffic in Gold Coast Airport.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah, right? Yeah.
And you need
yeah.
more bandwidth.
Yeah.
Then at night when nobody's there, you actually don't need the bandwidth.
Of course.
Right?
Yep.
So most of the time, the way we provision resources is by peak, is what you said. Like, you know, my peak demand is 100 megabits per second or a gigabit per second. So I need that. But you actually don't.
That's how
need
we build
that.
Roads, right? We say, okay, the roads have got to put a certain number of cars down during peak hour on a Monday morning.
Right.
So they've got to be six lanes because we need six lanes worth of traffic.
Right.
At night, there's still six lanes, but no one's using the road.
Exactly. So, but here, because it's a, you know, because it's data resources, what you're basically saying is, well, you know, some large multinational might be doing a lot of data transfer at night because they maybe are transferring stuff to America or to the Northern Hemisphere, right?
Okay.
So you could actually share the highway in that sense.
Right.
You know, the information highway, by taking care of the fact that somebody's going to use a lot of data at night, somebody's using a lot of data during the daytime, we can just make sure that each person gets what they want without actually having to pay for the full freight. So you only pay for the you know, you basically pay a toll for the time you're actually driving.
Really, really cool.
This is really cool. And so this company is interesting because, you know, when we recommended it, it was actually just had tipped over from gross margin losses to gross margin profit. That's a very dangerous.
That's early stage.
That's
too.
Very early stage, right?
So for our listeners, gross margin is not including all the sales costs, administrative costs, even the tech or the hardware costs. It literally is saying, what does it cost to provide the service for the actual, just the bits that go into it? So I'll use a very simple example. If you're making hammers, then your gross margin is the price you get for the hammers, less the cost of the wood and the bit of metal on top and a bit of the factory kind of allocated costs, but doesn't include the factory manager's time or the CEO's time or the sales and marketing team or the cost of sending it to the warehouse. It's literally just the products. That's the gross margin, is the product cost taken away from the sales price. And you're saying up until recently, or when you recommended it anyway, it was actually costing them more to provide the service than what they were charging for.
Yeah, and that was because, you know, they're building all... So basically, to do this, you need to build... you need some software, but you also need to build this interconnection with various data centers and, you know, cloud providers with, you know, internet network providers, right?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of upfront cost to build that network, to build these services in. And it's like a little bit of a chicken and egg story, right? Mm. You need to have the facility to be able to support the demand, right?
Yeah.
And to get that demand, you need to actually invest up front, right? And therefore, it's going to look like you're making a lot of losses up front. But it's a little bit like a telco. It's in a way, it's a bit like a telco company, right? You need to build the highway before you can actually pay for it. You can charge for it.
Yeah, so Vocus, for those of our listeners who remember Vocus from maybe 8 years ago now or so, I remember we recommended it at ShareAdvisor. My predecessor, Dean, recommended it for ShareAdvisor, and it went nowhere for about 3 years, share price wise, because it was making losses. Because, as you say, that was exactly what it was doing. It was rolling out cable, and all of a sudden, the rollout was done, and they were signing up new customers. And the cost of new customers coming on was almost zero because it was all there. As you say, the cost of the extra car on the freeway is nothing, but you get, you know, $5-7, whatever the toll is these days, for the trip. That's almost pure profit, right? Because you've already put the cost in.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, so right now, I think the business is scaling. So, they, you know, delivered 70% growth in revenue for the half over half. They have expanded operations to Japan. They're in Europe. They're in America. So, I think, you know, still this company has a lot of, it requires to build scale up, but they're in a nice spot now. And now the question really is not about necessarily about investment in data centers and the scale. The scale now really is about sales and marketing. You really need the sales and marketing to deliver you the clients at a nice, healthy clip.
Yeah.
And you know, so yeah, it's still a very, you know, in my view, risky company.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, there's upside and there's downside. You know, we realize that, you know, this, you know, it's again the leader in the space in on the ASX. I think there's no other company that does what they're doing.
Is that the risk that someone comes along and commoditizes the offering?
I mean, there's always that risk. I mean, with all of those things, there's always the risk. I think the thing is that, you know, if you can build enough, if you can get to escape velocity, you have tied up enough clients, and they've, you know, they've got enough number of interconnects signed up, and you know, you're globally there.
From the investment case, for our listeners who are saying, Doc, you sound like you're making lots of sense. I love this company already. I just want to kind of balance it out by sharing some of the risks. So if you were thinking about investment, you're right. I don't mean to say it's bad because there are risks, just to share both the up and downside potential.
Yeah, so I think that's right. So I mean, the thing is, in my view, it's still not reached escape velocity yet,
right,
in that sense.
Right.
Once it reaches escape velocity, I think this is, you know, like, I mean, anybody can build, in theory, anybody can build data centers, but you know, scale matters, right? So sort of in this, you know, elastic bandwidth sharing too, scale matters, right? And that's what they're really doing, building scale. So that's always a risk. I mean, but yeah, I think this is a company that you watch every half or every quarter when they launch their 4C. You see how what their trajectory is, how many data centers have they signed, how many interconnects have they got, how many new markets have they got, and you know, how many clients are they signing. And I think those are things that you observe. Definitely a riskier investment.
But very cool tech, right?
It's very, very cool tech. I think I love the tech, and I think, you know, the company has done, you know, again, it's, you know, local Australian technology that is sort of global, which is brilliant. I love those type of companies which, you know, to take the tech here and expand overseas. So that, you know, it's got a lot of overseas revenues as well. So yeah, I think risky, but interesting.
That's Megaport. MP1 is the code, though, if you're following along at home. And Elmo is ELO. The other companies, we figure Telstra, CBA, and Blackmores, you could probably find for yourselves. But Elmo and, excuse me, and Megaport are two that Doc particularly likes. I think they're really interesting and really exciting little companies with some risk, but certainly well worth a look. Megaport's a buy for you guys as well, right?
Yep, absolutely.
Mate, I feel like a bit of a telco podcast. There's going to be a better word for the telco these days, isn't there? Like, I know Telstra's a telco, and I know TPG's a telco, and Megaport's kind of in the same space, but should we call them data companies now or something? Because telco, it's not really telecommunications anymore, is it?
Well, I mean, Telstra is telecommunications, right?
But it's kind of mostly data, really, even though. I mean, it's telecommunications only in the sense that that's what it's morphed from. You know, in the old days, Telstra was known as the Postmaster General's Department because it was part of the post office at one point, and then they were doing communications, and so it kind of felt like it was part of the post, and then it was different. I mean, it's not a big deal. I'm wondering at some point whether, you know, realistically, I'm going to say 95% of Telstra's traffic is now data-based, right? Whether it's whether it's IP telephony or whether it's actual data, at some point, they're almost not telcos anymore.
Well, my distinction really is, a telco is a company that provides data transmission services.
Right.
A data company is a company that takes the data and makes sense out of it.
Oh,
so if it's not making sense out of data,
that's a good point.
It's just carrying other people's data.
They're
not supposed to be looking at that data anyways.
Right, that's right.
That'll be a breach of my privacy.
Just pushing it through.
Yeah.
So speaking of which, mate, the reason I say that is because we've got another telco data transmission story, I'm going to call it. It won't catch on, but I'll try. TPG and Vodafone, we found out yesterday afternoon, we're recording this on Friday morning on Valentine's Day, as I mentioned at the top. They can now, speaking of Valentine's Day, love is in the air, they can maybe, finally, consummate this pending marriage. The federal court says the ACCC are wrong, Vodafone and TPG are right, and it can go ahead, unless the ACCC appeals again.
Yeah, the ACCC might appeal, I don't know. I have mixed feelings about this. I actually think the ACCC does a really good job about looking after competition.
Yeah.
In this case, I'm not really, I'm in two minds. I don't know. I think, like, you know, maybe a combined entity is a good thing. Maybe, you know, having a big player, you know, three big players is better than having one or two big players and a couple of smaller players. Right. I think that's the advantage. And if we are going to be in a 5G world, I think this marriage actually makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
So I think...
Because effectively TPG was a broadband business, and Vodafone's a mobile business.
Yeah.
Putting these two together makes it, to some degree, I'll say full service. I don't necessarily mean that in terms of one service for everybody, but a full service telco having those bits and pieces that it needs to be competing holistically with the Telstras and Opsis of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And Vodafone's backhaul, like fiber backhaul, is provided by TPG in most cases,
exactly.
Right? So there's already a relationship there.
Yeah.
And this could actually be very good for consumers in the sense that if they also roll out 5G, then we could have a lot of 5G competition. We have in this country, we actually got the fiber backhaul. It's the last mile that's the issue, right? Mm. And then we got a lot of fiber backhaul. So yeah, I like this idea of thing going on.
Very good. I'm in two minds as well, mate. Look, I've got to say, It's interesting the ideology that goes into this stuff. So the ACCC, the Federal Court, investors. Because if you look at it, when the deal was announced, Telstra share price went up, right? And that is unmistakably the market voting with its wallet and saying this will be good for Telstra, i.e. bad for competition, because four going into three, the better the market was, this means less competition. Vodafone, TPG is a bit of a, you know, they're a real price fighter. They're a bare bones operation. The CEO, David Teo, there, really, you know, known for cost cutting, for competing hard. Vodafone, part of Vodafone Hutchison Australia, kind of started off as this price fighter brand, but then kind of quickly became a bit like Virgin, you know, a full service brand that kind of did everything, and the prices weren't so keen anymore. The market was betting that this is bad for competition. Rod Sims, the ACCC boss, also saying it's bad for competition. The federal court saying, no, it's fine. There's no substantial lessening of competition. We can make these things can merge. I kind of with you. Look, and the other thing is TPG share price went up 10% on the news, you'd expect. I'm kind of with you, I think. I think it's probably a net benefit just, but I also, frankly, having, you know, as you've already said, Rod Sims doing a great job looking after competition to the extent that they are concerned this is a bad deal for consumers, I'm kind of almost inclined to just trust them, give it a rote, take their word on it. As I said, though, the federal court, very different view, decided it was okay. And unless the ACCC appeal, which they may, because Sims was pretty, I don't know what the right word is, he was pretty direct with his words after the case saying he thinks the court got it wrong. So to the extent they think, and this will be a legal question, right, rather than a philosophical question, they won't appeal because they think they're right. They'll appeal if they think they can convince a higher court they're right. That's a different distinction. We will see, but it looks like now maybe slightly more likely than not that the two get together.
Yeah, no, I think so. Again, there's a very good chance of appeal happening, is what I think.
Mate, this has been a fun conversation. We're almost out of time, but we've probably got, well, how about this, mate? How about we do a special bonus mailbag episode this Sunday?
Sounds
you
like
in?
Yeah, sounds like a good idea.
All right, we have a couple of questions we can answer before we finish, though, so let's get them on quickly, and then we'll have a bonus episode, which is kind of cool. The first one, excuse me, is from Twitter, from Melbo. Melbo says, hi, Scott. In your podcast, you were asking about whether anyone had a better rate than 3.3%, in brackets, I think. I have 2.84% with Eubank. Also, when I was late returning the forms, I think they panicked and offered to refund the government fee of $300. So obviously I took them up on that too. Melbo, that is awesome. 2.84%. There you go, fools. When if you're listening, if you're paying more than 2.84%, it's out there. Eubank are offering it. Why don't you do yourself a favor and, as we like to say, hashtag get a better rate. As I've said many, many times, and I will say many, many more times in the future, the banks don't deserve your charity. They don't need your money more than you do. Don't pay them more than you have to. Go to Eubank, go to someone else, or call your bank and say, hey, I hear Eubank offering 2.84%. What can you do for me? I'd be very, very surprised if most of you can't get a better rate with a single phone call, even if you don't have to change banks. And if you do change banks, you might save even more. So, Melbo, thank you for that. Thank you for being part of our Get a Better Rate campaign. Great to see it's working. Great to see you're saving some cash. And hopefully, our other listeners will be able to follow in your stead. All right, Doc, one more before we finish from Alex. Alex says, love the podcast, guys. Would be interested in some updated views on Kogan from Scott and Doc. I know you guys like the company and wonder if the recent sell-off following January results and maybe a little coronavirus panic presents a buying opportunity. Or has the story actually changed enough to have some caution here? Keep up the great work. Cheers, Alex. Doc. I'm actually, as I read this, I'm thinking, I'm not sure when Kogan are reporting. So hopefully it's not between now and when the podcast goes to air, or we may have a different answer. But on the assumption that it hasn't, based on what we know right now, on Friday morning, the 14th of Feb, what are you thinking about Kogan and its recent price falls?
Well, I mean, so maybe it's a little bit of an expectation game, right? So I think the growth expectation that the market had,
yep,
probably wasn't what the quarterly update, I guess, said. And, you know, the market probably sold off the shares. I mean, you know, like with Kogan, I think the thing to think about is it is playing in this sort of this secular trend. I hate using that word, but I'll use it anyways. it's playing in this online online channel, you know, movement of sales to online channel, right? So, and I think scale is a great thing there because, you know, you have certain fixed costs for doing things. More you sell, the more verticals you have, you know, more sticky it becomes to the customers, the more customers you get. So, I mean, those are all fantastic things where the scale absolutely helps you. So to me, it appears like they're still in the very early phases of that trend. Now, absolutely. Will there be competition? Yes, there is already competition here in the form of, you know, whether it's Amazon Prime or, you know, there's eBay and there's, you know, all these other shops that exist online. So, I mean, there's competition, but the competition is always there. But I think the net losers here are going to be the brick and mortar. So, you know, it's not that, you know, the competition is actually eating into Kogan per se. It's more like, you know, competition basically is making, in some sense, reinforcing the value of online. And, you know, it. So I think Kogan is a volatile stock. So it goes up a lot. It goes down a lot. I like the business. I like the leadership team of Kogan. I like what they do. I like how they think about the business. There's a lot to like in that business. I actually really like the business. Yeah. So I think it's in, again, coronavirus. Yes, it can have some impact in terms of sourcing. As I have already mentioned at the beginning, sourcing can become a problem. And if you can't source, then you can't sell. So, yeah, I mean, there is, I guess, reason for caution. But again, on a long-term basis sort of thing, for me at least, Kogan ticks many, many boxes. So I like the business overall. I like what they do. And I like sort of their attitude towards the long-term. And I think they have a big opportunity ahead of them.
Gratuitous plug too. We had Ruslan Kogan speak to us last Friday at a Motley Fool Platinum event, which is our highest tier service. He was really, really good. Didn't give us any inside information, of course, because he's not allowed to and we wouldn't ever want it. But it was really good to hear him talk about the business, the way they think about that operation, what they're looking to do. I was actually quite a little bit out of school, Doc, and I own Kogan shares. Also, I had Amazon shares. I'm about to talk about Amazon. I was really pleasantly surprised to see him speak. So not that I expect him not to necessarily, but he spoke really maturely and really supportively and glowingly about Amazon itself. You know, I said, look, I'm not sure whether you like the comparison between Kogan and Amazon. You know, some people don't like being compared to their competitors, no matter how big. They want to be different. They want to be unusual. They want to kind of, you know, make their own way. And Russell said, no, it's actually a flattering comparison. If you want to compare it to Amazon, they've done such a great job. They're a wonderful business. I actually quite like the comparison. And I have to say, you know, in a world of often brash startup CEOs or people who want to be their own person, and you know that there's often a bit of resistance to that sort of stuff. I was pleasantly surprised to hear him just be so happy to you know, not have to pretend that Kogan was something different and better and all that kind of stuff. He's like, no, these guys are great, and it made me feel a lot better about investing in Ruslan's company. Mate, that's gonna do us for today. I think we're almost there. I've got a little bit of a tease. If you're thinking about whether you're going to tune in on Sunday. Doc, I don't know if you've seen this question yet. You may have. It's been on our list for a little bit, but I found it the other day. There's a question from one of our listeners who says simply, "Hi, gents. Do you ever worry about getting caught up in the hype of company narratives like Berkshire and Tesla, and miss red flags or poor fundamentals?" And I'm going to ask you to opine on that on our bonus mailbag episode on Sunday. And so, listeners, if you could see Doc's smile right now. I have a feeling this is one episode you're not going to want to miss. What do you reckon, Doc?
I think it's going to be interesting.
All right, Phils, that wraps us up. Before we leave, though, if you're interested in finding out a little bit more about some of Doc's favorite companies, you should join his service, Motley Fool Extreme Opportunities. You can join for a very, very good price and a price just for our podcast listeners. We have a very special order page for those of you who are listening to this particular podcast or any of our podcasts, but certainly this particular one. If you go to fool.com.au/EO podcast, that's EO podcast, fool.com.au/EO podcast, you can get a very special price and get the opportunity to join Doc's service for a really, really good first year deal. You can find out more about Elmo, more about Megaport. I didn't ask about them, actually, as it turns out, specifically for that reason. I said to Doc when we were planning this one, let's cover the big ones that everyone talks about, and let's cover a couple of small techie ones because we know people want to hear more about what you're excited about. So it just so happens that's the case. That being said, by the way, the price is so cheap for EO. Frankly, it's too cheap, as I know Doc has said before. I agree. The good news is, as listeners and as potential members, You get the benefit of that because Doc has a very, very substantially market-beating scorecard, some great advice, some great education and commentary. You really want to be part of the Extreme Opportunities team. That's fool.com.au/EO podcast. And mate, that's it.
That's it.
But if you haven't yet, please make sure you do subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app. And if you like what we're doing, give us a rating. 5 stars would be lovely. Leave us a review. Tell your friends who couldn't do with a little more foolishness in their lives. And of course, don't forget, you get a dose of foolishness straight to your inbox by going to fool.com.au/Triple M. That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another dose of foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/triple M. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.